From Birmingham, Alabama, this is ARC Stories Radio. The stories you're about to hear are true, personal, and told by the people who lived them in front of a live audience at one of our ARC Stories events.
A few years ago, I went to Japan. As part of a cultural exchange program, I was told that I would be spending a week or so with a Japanese family who may or may not speak English.
I'm Taylor Robinson, and today we have three stories where our storytellers find themselves in situations completely over their heads. Some, literally.
We hear our guide say, "Oh crap, everybody hold on." And as we come up, the other raft hits us, and the raft flips over. And Mallory and I are trapped under the raft on a rapid.
We created ARC Stories to give Birmingham a place to tell its stories to the world. So coming up after the news, Birmingham's own true stories. Welcome to ARC Stories Radio. I'm Taylor Robinson, the director of ARC Stories, and I'm joined by my co-host and story coach, Chris Kinsley. Today we have three stories, each recorded throughout Birmingham at different ARC Stories events. They include one woman's discovery of whether or not you really can come home again, and another where a man struggles to create a connection across barriers of generation, culture, and even language. In our first story, a woman has the opportunity to fulfill a dream she's been pursuing most of her life. What makes it even better is that she also has the opportunity to share the experience with her daughter. However, they soon find themselves wondering whether or not this will be their last opportunity to mark anything off of their bucket lists. It's from an event we hosted earlier this month at the Avon Theater where our theme was Go Fight Win, stories about sports. Here's storyteller Sandy Wright Limmer.
About 20 years ago when I was a student at Sanford, on the weekends they would have whitewater rafting and it was free and all you had to do was show up. And I wanted to go, so I didn't want to go by myself and I asked my friends, "You guys want to go whitewater rafting?" And they say, "No." And I wouldn't go, and then it would come up again. I'd say, "Hey, anybody want to go whitewater rafting?" And they'd say, "Nope." And then one day one of my friends said, "Hey, you do know black people don't whitewater raft, right?" I said, "We don't?" She said, "No." And so I stopped asking. I never stopped wanting to go, but I stopped asking. And over the years, I found out that not only do black people not whitewater raft, but we don't bungee jump or parasail or snorkel or scuba dive. It's a whole bunch of stuff that we just don't do. Some years later, my family and I, we started attending this church, and the pastor got up and he said, "Hey, we're going to sponsor a trip to the Ocoee in Tennessee, and we're going to zip line, whitewater raft, and baptize." And I was like, "Yeah, finally, I'm going." And see, by that time, my oldest daughter was in her teens, so I had grown my own partner to go whitewater rafting. And she's pretty adventurous, so she's up for anything. And so the Saturday came, and we all got in the church vans and the cars, and we went up to the Ocoee. And the way they had it, you did the zip lining or the whitewater rafting, or you could do both. Now, I didn't want a zip line because that wasn't on my bucket list, and I don't really like heights. But my daughter wanted to do it, so I was like, "Oh, okay, we can do that." And if you've never been zip lining, they put you in this harness, and there's this strap that's attached. And on the end of the strap is a hook. And the hook attaches to a wire cord between platforms. Now, the platforms look like open-air tree houses, with the exception that there's a wall on the back. And so they give you the instructions, and you have these leather gloves on. And they say, when you get out there, about halfway there, the other guy will say, "Now." And you're supposed to take your hand with the glove, put it in front of the hook on the wire, and slow yourself down. Take your hand with the glove, put it in front of the hook on the wire, slow yourself down. Okay. So they went out, it seemed simple enough, and everybody was going, and it was my turn, and I get up to the edge, and you're supposed to kind of jump off. And that's when I realized how high up we actually were. And So I spent the next 1 or 2 minutes arguing with the guy because I'm not doing this. I'm not doing this. And so eventually he just pushed me off unexpectedly. And so the first pictures of me are of me screaming bloody murder to the other side. About halfway there, the other guy said, "Now." That was when I was supposed to take my hand and put it on that wire. Now, my brain said, "Hey, move to the wire." My hand said, "No, I'm good. And so I never put my hand there. And I heard the other guy say, "Ooh, she's coming in hot." And just like the Nile, they parted. And that's when I discovered that that wall wasn't really a wall, but a big piece of foam for people like me who don't have enough sense to slow themselves down. And just like Wile E. Coyote, I hit that wall, just cartoon style. And I was shaking up, and they all came and they took me off, and I was like, "I'm not doing that again. I am not going again." But of course, you know, they convinced me to go again. Well, about halfway through this whole ordeal, the guy said, "Hey, why don't we spice it up?" Okay. He said, "Now, when you get out there, I want you to let go, kind of kick yourself back, and flip." It's okay. They showed us how to do it. And I was like, "We can do it." So everybody's going there, just zip flipping and zip flipping. And my daughter, who is up for anything, she zips, she flips, she crosses her legs, she gives a rock ensemble, and she is going, yeah, all the way down, flips back up. The elderly man that drove the van up, he zips and flips, and his wife, who has to be like 68, she zips and flips. Well, it's my turn, because I'm last, because I've been hitting this foam, and my brain takes a little while to kind of reorient. And so I get up there, and of course he has to push me off, because I'm not going to do it on my own. And I get up there, and they say, "Flip." And I say, "I can do this. I can do this." And so I let go, and I kick back, and I flip. And it is so graceful. And I am so proud of myself, and I am smiling. And they said, "Flip back," and so I do. And I am so proud. And then I hit the mat, because I still can't slow myself down at all. So at the end of this, when you're getting ready for the Okoye, you can go and you can see the videos and the pictures. And I'm excited. I want to see this. And I know all of my normal zip pictures are just me screaming. But I want to see the flip. And so we get there and we see my daughter and she's doing it. And I'm like, "Yeah." And they get to my picture and I'm like, "So why didn't anybody tell me I didn't make the flip?" You see, everybody else is vertical and I'm horizontal. I never did go all the way up. And I look ridiculous because I got a big old grin on my face. But I'm like, okay, you know what? I didn't even want a zip line anyway. The Okoye is what I'm here for. So we go on down and we get to the Okoye. And, you know, I don't think I realized how heavy those rafts are. I think I had in mind, you know, the little blow-up things you do in the Lazy River. That's not what this is. It's really big and it's heavy. And it takes 6 of us to carry it. So there are 3 on this side, 3 on that side, and the guide is in the back. And they give you the instructions first, and they're saying, you know, your guide is the person that's going to tell you how to paddle and when to paddle, and that's what's going to steer you, and it's all about teamwork. And if you fall off and you get sucked under, then get in fetal position, and you'll shoot out. What? If we fall off and get sucked under... Okay, so we're going on, and honestly, it really was a whole lot of fun. I mean, it's like, have you ever been to on that Twirl-A-Whirl at the fair where you spin it? It's like if the Twirl-A-Whirl and the Raging River married and had a wilderness baby. That's what this was. We were just going, and the rapids, they're rated from 1 to 5 just based on how dangerous they are. And so we get to one, and it's not really that bad. It's maybe about a 3. And when you go on the rapids, it's kind of like a free fall, and then you come up, and it's splashing. And so we're on this rapid, and as we're going down, we see the guy going, "No, no, there's another raft coming." And as we go down, we hear our guide say, oh crap. Everybody hold on. And as we come up, the other raft hits us. And I'm on this side, and Mallory's across from me, and the raft flips over. And Mallory and I are trapped under the raft on a rampant on the Ocoee. Now, your first instinct is to push the raft off of you, but we can't because it's too heavy. And we're on the rampant, so the water is about right there, so we're having to lift up in order to breathe. And I'm holding on to her because she keeps getting sucked under, and she'll get sucked under, and I'll pull her up. But then comes that moment when she gets sucked under, and I can't hold on. And I'm there thinking, what just happened? My child is gone. Did I just see my child alive for the last time? Why did I bring us here? And then I started feeling hands on my legs, and I started to panic because I was thinking, just like in the movies, the dead river people have come alive and they're getting me, and I'm gonna drown here. And this is why black people should not whitewater raft, and I should have listened to them 20 years ago. But no, it was just the guys who got me from under the raft, and they had gotten Mallory from under the raft, but I didn't know that at the time. And so when I got from under it, and I'm on this rock, and I look and I see my child, and there's this enormous relief that my child is alive. I mean, it's incredible. We go on down the river to the part where we're going to baptize, and this part of the river is really calm. It's kind of man-made, and people would bring their children down so that they could play. And so this is where they're baptizing, and it's so peaceful, and it's so calm. And it's just like I think it probably was in the Bible. It's beautiful. Except for the part where, you know, the rafts were still coming down, and every time we baptized, they lift their paddles up and go, whoop-whoo! So I don't know if they had that in the Bible. But other than that, it's just like I think it's probably is in the Bible. As we were going home on the minivan, we're all kind of wet and we're all kind of cold and a whole lot tired. And I had my daughter next to me. I was thinking, you know, I always kind of thought I knew, but it wasn't until that trip that I realized just how precious life is and how important all of these moments are. And although it sounds cliche that, you know, we really should appreciate every single moment. Thank you.
Sandy Wright Leonard is an educator for One Day Surgery at Children's Hospital here in Birmingham. And I will be with you even then, even when I cannot see your face anymore. Sandy was actually a first-time storyteller, and I think people would have a hard time believing it because of how well told her story was, and it also just sounds so natural.
Yeah.
She's the perfect example of what we're always saying, and that is everyone has great stories, and anyone can tell a story well if you'll just take a little bit of advice. I was so proud of her.
Well, and I think that actually highlights something else we advocate at ARC Stories, which is that whenever people want to get into live storytelling, we often tell them to just begin by considering, what is the one story you always find yourself telling others, your friends, your family, people you meet for the first time? Start with that story, work on it, and before you know it, you will have a hit on your hands just like Sandy.
I also love how Sandy's story is just simple and it's straightforward. It's also exciting and funny. We don't know what's going to happen next. It's just a great story that's taken from everyday life, something that could happen to anybody. Our next storyteller is also a master at pulling great stories out of everyday life. However, in this particular story, it's a bit unusual because she pits herself in direct competition with Miss America. but it's not in the way that you're expecting. That's coming up in a minute on ARC Stories Radio, Birmingham's own true stories. This is ARC Stories Radio. We are bringing you true personal stories told live in front of an audience right here in Birmingham by the people who live them. I'm ARC Stories Director Taylor Robinson.
And I'm Chris Kinsley, the Media Director for ARC Stories. Folk wisdom says that you can never go home again. The idea is that when you leave home, you change and the people from your hometown change so that when you return, things just can never be the same. Well, when our next storyteller goes home again, she finds that proverb to definitely be true, but she also makes every attempt to create a new space for herself. From an event we hosted earlier this year where our theme was From the Ashes, Stories About Redemption, here's storyteller Eunice Elliott.
Okay, so I grew up in Bessemer, Alabama. Anybody ever heard of it? It's a place, right? It's a place. And so, in growing up in Bessemer, Alabama, you know, wherever you grow up, everybody's from somewhere. But when you're growing up there, you don't know how everybody else perceives you. And it's not until you start getting around people who are from other places that you realize, oh, I'm the one you're watching. And so you might feel it for your city, or you might feel it for your state or your school, you know, but as you get out, especially if you're an Alabama native, you get out and people really are like, wow, you speak such great English. You're from Alabama, really? You don't sound like it. I don't hear it. So growing up in Bessemer, Alabama, and that being my hometown, I've always heard, really, you're from Bessemer? You don't act like it. And I think, let me go ahead and cut them so they see where... It's a lie, it's a lie, it's not true, it's not true. So you have heard of Bessemer, okay. Because I wasn't sure if you had heard of Bessemer. Okay. But as the third child of four from a single mother growing up in Bessemer, Alabama, I always had an idea that I should be on stage. I never had a distinguishable talent. And so as a child growing up, I had stage presence, and me and my family would do little shows and skits, whatever, but I never knew what my talent was. And the reason why I was so attached to figuring out what my talent was is because I wanted to be in a pageant. Like, obviously, I am a pageant girl. I'm not sure why that's so funny. So I would tell my mom I was going to get in Miss Alabama pageant, and I would always watch Miss Alabama and Miss America, and I've never done this before on stage. So I would tell my mom, said, well, what would you be? Like, what's your talent? And I said, okay. So I would go and I would practice for my mom. Now, you guys probably don't know my mom, but my mom was one of those people that always just encouraged whatever little goofiness we wanted to share. She was like, do it, baby. Show me. And you're like, okay, mom. One of my famous early tricks, I'm one of those people that was blessed with a pot belly. You know, you ever seen a little kid walking around like they're like in their third trimester because they don't know how to suck it in yet? I was that kid, right? And she put a flower belt on me and it's like, hey, I'm here. So I had this trick when I was a little kid that I would bake bread for my mom. So I learned how to suck it in. I would lie on the floor and I would lift my shirt up and I would knead the bread. And then I would pull my shirt down and I'd let it rise and bake, right? And this was the thing. This was my talent, right? So sometimes my mom would say, make me some bread, baby, and I lay on the floor. Right? Encourage your kids is what I'm trying to tell you. You never know how it's gonna turn out. So at this point, I'm more mature, and my mom would say, what's your Miss America talent? And I say, you know, I don't get sing, and I don't tap, and I've tried ventriloquism. I'm actually going to bring that back out. I would have a puppet working on my brother's going to kill me, named Chico. And this is a little bit of the taste of the, because who else does ventriloquism other than in a pageant, right? I don't even think they do it anywhere else. But Chico is Spanish and he's shy, so he whispers everything to me first. Chico said, and so that way I don't, right? I'm totally about to kill ventriloquism, all right? It's getting added to my act very soon. I wish I had him tonight. Okay, so my mom would say, well, what's your Miss Alabama, what's your Miss America, you know, talent? And I would do this for my mom, and I would stand in, I would say, hi, I'm Eunice Elliott, I'm Miss Alabama. And my talent was playing my hand. Now, I don't know how many of you know how to play your hand, right, or what that even means. And I haven't played my hand in 1,000 years. I've never done this on stage. But playing my hand, I would play songs like this. Right? And so I had this whole thing where I was going to be so beautiful and in my gown, and I was going to say, "Hi, I'm Eunice Sally. I'm Miss Alabama." And then I can harmonize it. I would like play like the Star Spangled Banner and stuff. My mom was like, "You go, baby, you do it." But alas, I never was in a pageant. The closest I ever came to being in a pageant was when I was in high school, and I went to Jessalynnere High School, and my teacher said, "You should get in the Miss Jessalynnere pageant." And I was like, "Oh, okay, this thing where I just line up around other girls and I have to wait on somebody to tell me I'm the cutest? No, thank you. Probably won't go well if you don't agree with me." And so, because I had stage presence, they actually let me host the Miss Jessalynnere pageant as a student. And it was a teacher who used to do it every year, and that year they let me host it. And I was like, "See, I'm supposed to be on stage and I'm not being judged. This is amazing." So life goes on, and I attend the University of Alabama, Roll Tide. And I'm this little black girl from Bessemer, Alabama, who has no distinguishable true talent. And I'm in journalism classes, and I'm sitting in class with girls who were like Miss Alabama. Right? You go to college, you're like, and these people are like Miss Alabama or been in Miss Alabama pageants. And I'm sitting there like, "Are you kidding me right now?" And so in that moment, I told myself, "Okay, I gotta come up with a shtick. Because if we're graduating with the same degree in the same class, Miss Alabama is gonna get the job." And so I kind of told myself no. And so what I did is my shtick was I decided to be the black sports chick. I got real interested in sports. I started writing sports for the school paper at Alabama and the school yearbook, and I worked for the athletic department, and I grew into this really successful career in sports. I worked at ESPN. I worked for the Tennessee Titans. I worked for the Orange Bowl committee. I worked for an agent. I started my own PR firm representing professional athletes, and so I had a really good time, really successful. So even though I had told myself no, I probably won't get that job if Miss Alabama is actually going for it, I still had a really good ride in what I was doing. And then one day, I just had this really great idea to quit my job. I was working for myself. I was a publicist for professional athletes. And I decided to move back to Alabama, and I called my family. I said, "I'm coming home. I'm just going to be a family member." And they're like, "No, no way." I was like, "Yeah, I'm going to just come home. I don't really have a plan." And I didn't have any attachments to being successful, because I've proven I can be successful. So now I just want to start over. And so my brother was here. He was a single dad living in Hueytown, Alabama. And I moved in with my brother and helped him with my nephew. And I really wasn't doing anything. I was just chilling. And I didn't realize a year had gone by until my younger brother, I was living with my older brother, Al. My younger brother said, "Yeah," Al said, "it's working out real good with you living there." He said, "You better than a wife." He probably don't even know that I know that. And I thought, that sounds odd for a sister brother. So I start figuring out, okay, what am I going to do? What's the next act of my life? I've done really well, and now if I had no attachments to success or money, what would that look like? And that's when I started doing stand-up comedy. And what's great about when you have this dream and a motivation and a goal, I started doing stand-up comedy, and I had no success or money, so it worked out exactly the way I dreamed it up. But the stand-up comedy was like something no one had ever thought about with me. Now, what's interesting is I didn't even remember. I got voted class clown my senior year in high school. And I didn't even want to take the picture because I totally should have gotten, you know, cutest girl, best dress, more like, class clown, what can I do with this? And so I started doing stand-up comedy, and I didn't tell anybody I was going to do it. I just started going to open mic nights and showing up, and I never went on stage. And I started here in Birmingham, and I would go and I would watch, and I never thought anybody was really funny. And I thought, oh, well, this is a breeze. You don't even have to be funny. I can totally do this. And so I started introducing myself as a stand-up comedian, and people would say, "Oh, you're a comic?" I was like, "Yeah." And they say, "Where do you perform?" I'm like, "Well, everywhere. Like, I mean, what? What are you talking about?" I had never been on stage before. And so I finally said it to the wrong or right person, and he said, "Hey, I have a show next week. Do you want to come do some time?" And I said, "Yeah." And I thought, I wonder what time is. what does that mean? Yeah, I'll be there. And I didn't tell anybody. I went by myself, and I was sitting there, and I didn't really have anything planned to say, but I thought I'll just go up there and be funny. How hard could it be, right? And so right before I went on stage, and I said to the guy, I said, well, how long should I be up there? He says, oh, I'm going to give you time. Do your thing. And I was like, okay, yeah, but how long should I be up there? And he's like, yeah, just do your thing. I'm giving you plenty. I was like, yeah, okay. So how many minutes is time? Like, what is that? And he says, like, 3 to 5 minutes. And I said, oh, okay, cool. So I got on stage, and I was the only female that night, and they always seem like they have to introduce you as the females as if their breasts won't give it away at some point during your time on stage. I'm glad he told them I was a female comic. And the first thing I can remember saying on stage as a stand-up comedian was looking out into this modest to intermediate crowd. And I said, you know, it was really weird. I'm only girl on the show tonight, and it's hard in communicating with men because he told me, you know, he was going to give me time tonight, and I didn't know what that meant. And I said, well, how long? And he said, oh, plenty of time. Do your thing. And I said, yeah, but how long is that? He said, plenty of time. Just do your thing. And I said, give it to me a minute. And he said, 3 to 5 minutes. And fellas, that really ain't a lot of time. So he's standing there looking. I was like, that's the first thing I remember saying on stage, and I hadn't planned it, and it had just happened, and when I said it, it was like breathing. I was like, oh, this is the easiest thing I've ever done. I don't have to play my hand. I think I can make this work. So I started doing stand-up comedy, and from doing stand-up comedy, I started doing commercials, and from doing commercials, I got like this national commercial, and I was still living in Birmingham, but I was going back and forth to Atlanta, and I finally decided to just move back to Atlanta to pursue a career in stand-up comedy and acting. And I found out early on in my acting classes that I wasn't an actor. I'm not going to do it for free is what I'm saying, you know? So I said, let me just say I'm a comic. I'm not going to say I'm an actress. So when I moved back to Atlanta, even though I had this great career and this great resume, I decided to go to a temp agency to try to get a job as a receptionist. And you would be amazed at how hard it is to get a job as a receptionist when you've never been one. And I finally got a job as a receptionist at PricewaterhouseCoopers. And I would sit there, and I would meet everybody, and they had these principals and investors and all these people. And I would say, hi, I'm Eunice. I'm the temp. And I would go on auditions, and I wouldn't book anything. And one day, I got a phone call from WVTM 13 in Birmingham saying, hey, we know of you. You've done some little fun stuff with us in the past. We're thinking about adding some personality to the morning show. Wanted to see if you'd be interested. And I thought, wow, you know, I mean, I don't know. It's a hard decision, like temp receptionist or TV. I don't know. Let me think about it. And so I came to meet with the general manager and the news director, and they said, we want to be in the Eunice business, and we feel like people all over the country will be talking about traffic in Birmingham if you're doing it. And I was like, word? What? Really? Okay. So I moved back to Birmingham. I had never been on live daily television before in my life, and I was 38 years old at that time. I'm 41 now, and they never told me what to do. They just said, oh, you start Thursday. And I was on TV for about 2 weeks, and I finally said, hey, guys, if anybody ever wants to tell me how to be on TV, I'd really appreciate it. I think I would do it. And I didn't know what I was doing, and I was trying to figure it out as I went along, but ultimately all I knew how to do was be me, right? And what was stressful about that is you guys all have HDTVs, and HDTV is the devil. And you know, I've never been on TV before, but now that I have this wonderful new superpower of chin hair, now you can see it in HD. Yes, yes, I have finally made it. And so I joined the show. I'm the traffic reporter. I'm adding personality. It's like I'm figuring it out. I had this bright idea to like cut all my hair off, start wearing a wig, and then take the wig off one day and be like, yeah, that's what we're doing now. And I just was 100% authentic to myself. And then one day they came to me and they said, Eunice, we need you to anchor the news tomorrow. And I looked around this crowded newsroom and I said, is everybody sick tomorrow? Why would I ever anchor the news? Now, sidebar, back when I was at Alabama, I had talked myself out of it, but I did graduate with a degree in journalism. I did do internships, and I realized early on, I don't like doing bad news. I don't like talking about sad things. I don't like for someone's house to burn down, and I'm like, was everything you own inside that house? This can't be my life. So I don't think I want to do the news. Sports was light. I mean, nothing ever bad happens in sports, right? Hashtag OJ. So You know, my thing is like, no, I have no interest. I don't want to do the news. And so they say, yeah, you're doing the news tomorrow. I was like, no, thank you. I'm good. And they're like, no, you're doing the news. I was like, no, really. I'm good. And the next day, I sat on the anchor desk for the first time, and my heart is racing, and I'm sitting across from Ken Lass, who I grew up watching. And I told Ken, I said, I can't look at you because I'm going to get emotional because, oh, my, I've been on TV with Ken Lass for like a year and a half, but this is the first time, like, oh, my God, I'm on TV with Ken Lass. And I'm sitting up here. And the reason why anchoring is so different is because when I was doing the traffic, it's whatever I said. You know, TV traffic is whatever I say it is, guys. When you're watching it, you're not there. You don't know. Right? No stress. It's an accident on 65. You get to 65, there's no accident. I'm like, it's cleared up by the time you got there. I cannot be wrong. Easy breezy. But you're doing the news, you're reading. And you know, there's a difference between a conviction and an indictment and a suspect and an arrest and a murder and a manslaughter. And you're like, oh my God, and these words are going by. And it's amazing how you can read words and spell words and write words and know what they mean, but you've never said them out loud. Like I had never said cardiovascular out loud. Is that how you say it? Do you say cardiovascular? Okay, I got it. So now I did that one day. It was pretty horrible, pretty painful. And a few days later, they say, hey, we need you to fill in. And then people start taking vacation. And hey, we need you to fill in. And every time I did it, I got more comfortable, but I still was not attached to this idea of ever talking about death and murder and fires and car accidents. And I just don't want to do this. This isn't my personality. And so Ken Lass came in one day and said he was retiring. And they came in and they said, hey, Ken's been on TV 43 years. We're going to do a nationwide search. We're going to let you guys know. But if you guys have any idea of who could be the morning show anchor, come and let us know. So there's this gorgeous guy in New Orleans named Charles Divins. Google him later. And he used to be on a soap opera, and now he's on the morning show in New Orleans. And I went to my boss. I was like, what's this dude named Charles? I think we could be number one. All we need is Charles. And then I said, listen, I understand I've never been a reporter. I understand I've never been an anchor. But I'd like to, you know, I'm here. So if y'all audition a bunch of folks and it don't work out, let me know. I'm here. You know, I might figure out how to not hate it. My boss said, oh, of course, we should have told you you would be considered. And they brought in six candidates, and two of them were former Miss America contestants. And they brought them in, and we met them, and we ran with them, and we auditioned, and they said, great, thank you for coming, we'll let you know. And they sent the candidates all to New York, and that's where our corporation headquarters are. And then I got called into the office, and they said, we told you we would keep you up to date on our search for an anchor person. And you came in here early on in the process and said you had the perfect person. And I said, oh, my God, we got Charles. And he said, no, you said it was you. And he handed me a contract and said, it has been a joy watching you earn this job. And that was the day I was confirmed that I was so much cooler than Miss America. Thank you.
In all your bars, you'll always be Miss America. We watched you fly, but nothing's free, Miss America.
Eunice Elliott is a motivational speaker, stand-up comedian, and the morning co-anchor on WVTM NBC 13 here in Birmingham. Learn more about her at her website, euniceworld.com.
Now, Eunice obviously has lots of experience speaking in front of crowds. She's a stand-up comedian. She's a TV news host. But her story and the story before it are a perfect example of what I love about our events. It doesn't matter if you're a well-seasoned public speaker, performer, storyteller, or if you're a first-timer who's never done it before. We're bringing together all kinds of people from all different walks of life to tell and hear great stories because it's one thing we all share.
I've always said that stories have the power to bring people together like nothing else can. They really can overcome any difference, language, culture, even time. And sometimes the stories themselves are about having to bridge those differences. And that's the case in this next story, when our storyteller finds himself in a foreign land surrounded by strangers with no idea how to communicate or even what exactly is going on around him. Does he find his way? That's next on ARC Stories Radio, Birmingham's own true stories. Thanks for joining us for ARC Stories Radio, Birmingham's true stories told by the people who lived them and recorded in front of a live audience. I'm ARC Stories Media Director Chris Kinsley.
And I'm Taylor Robinson, the director of ARC Stories. Ira Glass, who hosts This American Life, has said before that great stories happen to those who can tell them. And I agree, but I also think great stories can happen to people who intentionally create opportunities for great stories to happen. Our next storyteller left everything and everyone he knew to move to the other side of the world to live with people whose language he didn't know and whose culture he didn't understand. It's from an event we hosted last month at the Avon Theater where our theme was Lost in Translation, Stories of Misunderstanding. Here's storyteller Brad Tolan.
A few years ago, I went to Japan. As part of a cultural exchange program, and as part of that program, I was told that I would be spending a week or so with a Japanese family who may or may not speak English. And so I was excited to go, and a party was arranged for us all Americans to go there and then to meet our Japanese host families. And it was at this party that I met Keiko. And Keiko came up and sort of introduced herself to me, but she motioned for me to follow her, and I did. And then she motioned for me to go out into the parking lot with her, and I did. And then she motioned for me to get into her car, and I did. Now, normally I am not in the habit of getting into cars with complete strangers when I'm 10,000 miles away from home, and I don't speak the language, but I figured, Japan. And so I did. And so for the next hour, Keiko and I tried valiantly to communicate with each other. And in the course of that hour, as we drove through the streets of the city of Hitachi, I learned three things about Keiko. One, Keiko is married. Two, Keiko has two children. And three, Keiko speaks even less English than I thought she originally did. So we pull up to a house, I'm guessing it's Keiko's, and she motions for me to follow her inside, and she takes me to a bedroom, and she leaves me there. And I assume, okay, this is where I'm staying, all right? And so I start to unpack, and jet lag begins to take hold, and I'm getting really tired really fast. And that's probably why I didn't notice the petite, elderly Japanese woman that had come in the room behind me and then started talking to me really loudly, rapid-fire Japanese. And I spun around holding a big bundle of my underwear, and I just looked at her. And she kept on talking. I thought maybe I was in her room, but she was totally not cool with me being there. So I didn't know what was going on, and it just went on and on and on and on. And then behind her, a little elderly Japanese man came in, and he started talking to her, and she continued talking to me, and then she waved him off dismissively and turned back around and gave me the biggest, most sarcastic eye roll I have ever seen. And I teach teenagers, right? And so I don't know what's going on. I'm still just standing there looking at this conversation chain going on. And then he reaches up and he puts his hand on her shoulder. And they both turn around and start talking to each other, go into the hallway, across the hall to another door, quickly walk inside and slam it behind them. What was that? I had no idea. I was literally sitting there shaking. I was so like confused by what was going on. And I certainly couldn't go and ask Keiko because literally I could not ask Keiko. Well, a little while later, I was summoned downstairs, and we sat on the floor, and Keiko and I had a very quiet dinner opposite each other. And she served me some green leafy things I couldn't identify, and some fried things I certainly couldn't identify. And in the middle of this awkwardness, the front door opened, and a man walked in, and he walked right over to me, he stuck out his arm, and in crystal clear English, he said, "Hello, my name is..." And I sat there, and I looked at him, I was like, "I don't know." And he goes, "Binko." Well, of course it is. And so Binko explains that he is actually Keiko's husband and that it's a duplex and those are Binko's parents. Those are his parents living in the house with us. So I'm totally relieved. I didn't hallucinate at all. My fears are relieved. I decide now is the perfect time for me to go to bed. It's 7:30 at night, but, you know, I'm a million miles away from home. Call it a day, count your losses, get up and get a fresh start the next day. And so I excused myself, and I went to bed, and I slept hard that night. Really, really hard. Until 3:30. And then I woke up at 3:30 in the morning, wide awake, like 4 cups of coffee, wide awake. And in my delusional state, I figured the best thing I could do at 4 o'clock in the morning is to go out and explore the city of Hitachi on my own. And so I quietly got dressed, and I tiptoed down the hallway, and I put my shoes on, and I quietly opened the door so I wouldn't wake anybody else up, and I walked out into the big city of Hitachi. And let me tell you, at 4 o'clock in the morning, there is nothing to see or do in the big city of Hitachi. No people, no cars, nothing open, nowhere. And I gave up, and I turned around, and I went back home in total failure. And I quietly opened the front door. And I bent over and I took my shoes off. And I added them to the stack by the door. And when I stood up, the old lady was standing at the end of the hall looking at me again. And she didn't care that everybody else in the house was asleep. And she started talking crazily to me in nothing but Japanese. And she started motioning for me to follow her. And I said, okay. And so I followed her. And we went down the hall and she went to her door. And then she opened the door and I stepped inside. And it was like Alice going through the looking glass. Suddenly I found myself in her kitchen. And I looked around and there were pots and pans and dishes and glass jars and everything piled up. And where there wasn't something piled up on a counter, there was a crochet doily. And I looked at this woman who was still talking to me, and I looked at the kitchen, and weirdly, it was suddenly all very familiar. The kitchen and the old lady reminded me of my grandmother. Now, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that my grandmother ate with chopsticks, and I'm not going to tell you that she ate exotic seafood, and she certainly wasn't Japanese. None of those. However, at this point in my life, I had one surviving grandparent, and I had grown very close to her. She was 96 years old. And if I was going to describe her to you, I would probably tell you that she was a weird mix between, do you remember the character Weezer in Steel Magnolias? She was a little bit Weezer and a whole lot Mr. Magoo. But she had the added bonus of not only being mostly blind, she was also mostly deaf. And she had talked very loudly to compensate. But for whatever reason, we had grown very close, and I really enjoyed sitting and listening to her, and she enjoyed having an audience. And it suddenly struck me that this must be a very similar situation. So here was this elderly lady, and we were bonding, and she kept talking, and I was thinking, oh, this is such a warm feeling. And I noticed she keeps doing this to me. Like, what is that? And I turn over and I look, and oh, there's the old man from the other night sitting in the floor at a little table, and he's waving me over. And I'm like, oh, okay, sure. So I go over and sit down next to him. He's reading a newspaper, and he pulls out a piece of the newspaper and hands it to me, all in Japanese. And I play along and start reading it, you know what I'm saying? I flip in the pages and looking at the pictures and oohing and aahing over everything inside. And then the old lady comes back over and she gives me a cup of green tea and she lays down a plate with a sliced apple on it. And then she sits down at the table with us and they turn on the TV. And we start watching something that I can only describe to you as being a cross between Good Morning America and the $10,000 pyramid. Right? And so they're watching this weird show, and occasionally they would point at the TV, and they would laugh, and then they would look at me and explain the joke, and I would laugh, right? And we were just having the best time. And in my head, I realized, I am kind of falling in love with these people, right? These people are going to be my Japanese grandparents. I am going to call these people, in my head, Grandmama-san and Grandpapa-san, right? No, in Japanese, san is a suffix. It is a sign of endearment, right, of respect. It's like Mr. or Mrs. in English. So to me, it wasn't offensive, but who knows. But I called him in my head, Grandmama-san, Grandpapa-san. And then when breakfast was over, Grandmama-san got up to clean the table, and me being a good Southerner, I helped. And she was very impressed with this. And she thanked me, and she bowed to me, and she patted me on the head. And about that time, she started motioning for me to follow again. And she led me to the back door of the house, and we went outside. And the first thing I noticed was on the side of the house, there was this weird water feature, a koi pond and a fountain, but it was in a weird location. But Grandmama-san really wanted to show me her vegetable garden. And so we started walking around, and she was pointing out various different things and just talking up a storm, and I was nodding and oohing and aahing over the plants. But as far as I know, she could very well have been saying, "That damn neighbor's dog is crapping in the yard again." But nonetheless, I was there, I was present in the moment, and when she bent over to start pulling weeds, I had a flashback. I grew up with my grandparents who always had gardens, and so when I saw an elderly person weeding a garden, what did I do? I started weeding that garden too, and she was thoroughly impressed by this. And about that time, Binko came back out and said, "Party's over, we gotta go, we gotta adventure for the day." And so Grandmama-san and I bowed to each other, and I left. Now, Binko, in his wisdom, had decided that the thing that a guy in his 30s would really want to do on his first time in Japan is go to a museum full of Japanese teacups. And so luckily for Binko and for me, I guess, there was the world's biggest Japanese teacup museum right there in Hitachi. And so that's where we went. And we spent the whole day looking at Japanese teacups. I wasn't terribly into it, but it did give me the opportunity to talk to Binko and get to know a little bit about his family. And he explained to me that his father had been an executive with the Hitachi Corporation for many years. But his mother was a master or mistress of the Japanese tea ceremony. Now, the Japanese tea ceremony goes back to at least the 1500s in Japan. It is an incredibly well-choreographed way to make a cup of tea, but it is so much more than simply making a cup of tea. It is full of tradition and movement, each flick of the wrist, each stirring of the spoon, each whisking the whisk has a symbolic meaning to it. And it is something that is done for a revered guest in your home. Grandmama-san was so well regarded at doing this in Japan that people from all over Japan and from all over the world came to her home to take lessons from her. I was now very impressed with Grandmama-san. And that night, when I came back home, I was gobsmacked by what I found. In the room where we had had dinner the previous night, I saw a complete transformation. The back wall of the room was now gone. It was exposed to the backyard, and centered in the view was that water feature, the pond, in the back. Where the table had been, there was now a fire pit. And above that, a thick chain hung, hanging a kettle of boiling water over the flames. There was a red mat on the ground with spoons, whisks, bowls, and cups. And standing in the middle of it all was Grandmama-san. And she bowed very deeply and very seriously to me, and she motioned for me to come inside. And over the course of the next 3 hours, I sat in front of her while she conducted the full tea ceremony in my honor. It was one of the most moving experiences of my life, and I can't even explain to you the nuance of it, but it touched me deeply. Well, over the course of the next week, we all seemed to fall into a routine with each other. Every morning, I would get up at some ungodly hour and go for a walk through the neighborhood. I would come back home and have breakfast with Grandmama-san and Grandpapa-san, and when our game show / morning news was over, I would go with Binko and or Keiko on an adventure for the day. And at night, as I was getting ready to go to bed, Grandmama-san would come into my room. And she would sit down and she would talk to me in Japanese for a good 15, 20 minutes. I always assumed she was telling me about her day. She may have been bitching about Grandpapa-san, I don't know. They had been married a long time. But she would always leave by patting me on the head and giving me a little piece of chocolate. Well, a few months after I got back home, my real grandmother died. And after the funeral and the days went on, I thought a lot about my grandmother, and I thought a lot about Grandmama-san. And I thought about the connection that I had with both of these women and how touched I was by both of them, despite the fact that they had an enormous cultural divide between them. And in the case of Grandmama-san, there was also an enormous language barrier. But in the short time she and I had together, she profoundly touched me and changed me as a person. And that was something I didn't need a translation for. Thank you.
Brad Toland is a teacher, lawyer, and lifelong learner and adventurer. You can find out more about his various travels at his website, tolandtravels.com.
I love how Brad was just down. I mean, he was open to any kind of experience that could happen to him while he was in Japan. It's my favorite.
I actually think that's a good challenge to all of us, to not get so caught up in ourselves, but to be available to other people around us, no matter how different they might seem to be. We obviously live in a very divided culture right now, but when you boil it all down, people need other people in their lives. And in reality, we all have more in common with each other than you might think.
So, that being said, if you enjoyed listening to today's stories and you want to hear more, please join us at one of our live events. The next one is Saturday, October 15th at the Avon Theater. Our theme is Spooked, stories that go bump in the night. We're still looking for a few stories, so if you'd like to submit one or simply get your tickets, you can do all of that on our website, arcstories.com.
Thanks for listening to ARC Stories Radio. This program happens every month because of our partnership with WBHM. We especially need to thank Michael Crowell, Program Director at WBHM, who is vital to making the show a reality. The original idea for an ARC Stories radio show goes to Audrey Atkins, Marketing Manager, and Will Dahlberg, Membership Manager. Engineering support is provided by Daryl McCullough. Recording and mastering is by Eric Chapman from Symmetric Sound. Upper Air Creative does all of our design, and Territory 3 provides our website. Special thanks to Betsy Lee, Aaron Moon, Nate Dreger, and Sam Goodwin for making this episode possible. If you like today's stories, please subscribe to our podcast. You can find it on iTunes, SoundCloud, or on our website, arcstories.com. There you can listen to other stories, you can stay up to date with all of our events, and you can even submit your own story to tell. After all, we are always asking, what's your story?